Hello, this is Background Briefing. Today, not with Ian Masters, who's on a well-earned vacation. I'm Tom Lutz. I teach at UC Riverside, and I'm the editor of the Los Angeles Review of Books. This is my second time guest hosting for Ian Masters, which makes me feel a little bit like Joey Bishop. It also makes me wonder how old you have to be to get that joke. My guest today is Tom Hayden, to whom this show's listeners need no introduction, but you're going to get one anyway. We'll be joined over the course of the hour by three of my contributors and editors at the LA Review of Books, Seth Greenland, Don Franzen, and Ruben Martinez. Tom Hayden is the director of the Peace and Justice Resource Center in Culver City. He's the author of 19 books and hundreds of articles in books, journals, newspapers, and magazines, although perhaps no single one of them launched quite as many ships as the 1962 Port Huron Statement, the call to arms of the Students for a Democratic Society, which he helped found. Tom spent 10 years in the California State Assembly and 8 in the State Senate, and has been at the forefront of dozens of progressive, democratic, and environmental movements over the last 5 decades. Welcome, Tom.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. I think what I'd like to do is start with war. And first, I'd like to thank you for keeping me out of Vietnam. by the time my draft number came up, troops were coming home.
You don't owe me anything.
But it was in no small measure because of the anti-war activism of you and your colleagues. At the top of your agenda for the last 50 years has always been, put most broadly, human rights, justice, and your anti-war activities from Vietnam to Afghanistan are part of that. Over those nearly 50 years, the military, industrial, financial, political complex has become even stronger, it seems. Operational spending on Iraq and Afghanistan dwarfs the total outlay for Vietnam. The cost of Iraq alone in adjusted dollars surpassed Vietnam back in 2009. Are we ever going to make some headway?
Well, it's a good question. On the one hand, doesn't appear that we'll ever make any headway, but of course, that's not true. The war in Iraq is over, for example. It's kind of a obligation to see progress in a context of regress. Mm. And it's hard to know the balance. It's really very difficult.
Your most recent book is on Afghanistan, and we are we're winding down there. Winding down fast enough?
It's not as rapid a retreat as some of us would desire. I myself actually, I supported Barack Obama for president while opposing his plan for Afghanistan, and that was almost 5 years ago. And finally, we're getting out in terms of combat troops, leaving the country devastated. There will be a political squabble over residual forces and bases. I'm not sure that'll go well for anyone concerned. Look at the end of Iraq, which was supposed to be this necessary endeavor. Now we have, in this morning's papers, Iraq is servicing the shipment of weapons by Iranian planes. So we spent all that life and fortune on Iraq and wound up with a pro-Iranian government. So I don't think that there's necessarily a happy ending on the horizon for Afghanistan, but there's an ending.
And is there anything that can be done to make it a happier ending? That is, anything that people should be working on here?
There are some people in the peace movement who would be very, very concerned about humanitarian assistance to compensate for damage done. There would be people very concerned about preservation of very fragile rights of women to schooling and participation that have been eked out in an extremely male authoritarian society. Mm-hmm. what leverage the United States government has, what leverage specifically Hillary Clinton has, remains to be seen. But I suppose as a condition for ultimately getting everything else out, there could be some agreement about preserving those small gains and rights. But it's an ugly picture.
You mentioned Hillary Clinton. She's on her way out of this job, presumably Susan Rice is on her way in. The kind of Republican sideshow about it aside, is this a good thing for the administration?
Well, I mentioned Hillary Clinton because she's worked hard on women's agendas, women's issues. Mm-hmm. In foreign policy, unlike previous secretaries, and she's the presumptive candidate for president next time. She has an interest in women's rights in Afghanistan. She is quite hawkish. She was more hawkish than Barack Obama in 2008. I think Susan Rice is in that model. Susan Rice is quite hawkish, one of these people that, is labeled a humanitarian hawk. On the other hand, extremely competent, and Obama is entitled to appoint who he wants as Secretary of State, and I think what the Republicans are doing is ridiculous. They're trying to get John Kerry, of all people, to be the Secretary of State so they can run Scott Brown for Senate seat. And everybody knows it in Massachusetts, and I think as it dawns on people, it'll backfire on them. They're still fighting the election.
Yeah, somewhat inexplicable. And
I think it's a hangover. It's a aftershock. It's hard to recover from what everybody went through for the past year or two.
To kind of switch gears a little bit, you've also been active in the cause of environmental justice. Yesterday, we were talking briefly about the infrastructure rebuild on the East Coast and the possibility that climate change, which of course is a factor in the severity of the storm, might also be important to the way that the infrastructure is rebuilt. That's obviously your hope. Is it a possibility?
I think that's true. I think you also politically add Bloomberg and Governor Christie to the vocal advocates, along with Governor Cuomo, for green infrastructure, rebuilding, whatever you want to call it. The Obama budget package has $50 billion for new infrastructure, and I think the cost of New Jersey and New York alone will be $150 billion in direct costs. And I don't know where that money will come from, but it adds great clout to the argument that we have to protect ourselves against the extreme weather, which is a reflection of the changing climate. And the environmental movement, I think, stands to make great gains if they can fight district by district for the complete redoing of our environmental standards, not only in automobiles, which the president has done, but in all building construction and in the priority of weatherization and insulation and storm protection, all defensive measures, infrastructure measures, kind of things that employs a lot of building trade workers, and at the same time in green jobs and a huge down payment on the overdue bill. So I think it's very important, and I would hope and pray that Obama stresses climate change in his State of the Union.
And do you think that this is going to include, for instance, more mass transit rather than highway rebuilds and that kind of thing, or is it will it affect policy that far down the road?
I think Jerry Brown wants to be the vanguard on that subject on the national scene. I suspect the way politics works, there'll be an advance for mass transit, a lot of emphasis on new technologies rather than just trains, but there'll be plenty of highway money for you might ask our man downtown here, Antonio Villaraigosa. I think he could have a lot to say about transit policy.
In terms of the East Coast rebuild, did anything like that happen in the rebuild on the Gulf Coast? That is, were these kind of environmental standards at work there?
I think there was some progress. They were caught with a problem that they'd created, but almost insoluble, and that was that they had destroyed the wetlands to such a degree on the New Orleans coast that it made that flooding all the more likely. And the same is true with the East Coast, the Jersey Coast and New York. And people that want to get rid of Wall Street may have their way just by flooding sometime in the next 10 or 15 years. So the rebuilding will have to be... I think some kind of retreat. I can't imagine them bailing out the coastlines the way they were, but the coastlines are now so vulnerable that the rebuilding is going to have to be on higher ground, so to speak.
Mm. You know, we were already talking about the environmental disaster of our taste for fossil fuels back in the 60s. I was one of the hippies cutting my firewood.
I know with
handsaws to save on the chainsaw gas. One of your more recent books is "The Long '60s" from 1960 to Barack Obama, and I guess as that comment implies, and my earlier one about the continuation of the military-industrial complex. Sometimes I look around for vestiges of the idealistic 60s and that helped form me. And sometimes I've had a hard time finding them. Your book suggests that the effects of the 60s have been more lasting and profound than it sometimes seems.
Oh, I think far more, which is not to, stand on that claim and be content. But, there's people that would have us forget the 60s altogether. I think the process of social change is what we want to talk about. There were dozens of very specific gains from the 1960s, but they came as a result of mass movements and uprisings, but they came in disguise often, and people forget as a result of the disguise. Just to give you an example, you had the Earth Day. There were 20 million people in 1970, seemingly out of nowhere, and the passage of very far-reaching environmental worker safety legislation, all signed by Richard Nixon. So people don't go around saying Nixon was a hero of the 60s, but it turned out that... the 60s produced legislation which he, as a Machiavellian politician, found in his interest to sign.
Yeah, let's talk a bit about the process of social change. I want to bring in Seth Greenland to join us. He's a novelist, playwright, screenwriter, and a contributing editor to the Los Angeles Review of Books. His most recent novel, set in Palm Desert, is The Angry Buddhist, and it has an electoral campaign in the center of its action. His most recent screenwriting and producing credits are on Big Love. And in both of those narratives, he's interested in the possibility and improbability of ethical political dealing. We were talking yesterday, Seth. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We were talking about the waning of political activism among young people.
Well, yeah, I'd love to get Tom's thoughts on this because, for 50 years, you've been at the forefront of remarkably effective social action. You know, you contributed hugely to the end of the war in Vietnam. And in many ways, what we're facing environmentally today is much more dangerous than what we were facing when we were fighting in Southeast Asia. And it seems that with the exception of certain pockets of the younger generation, they don't sense the danger, or at least they're not manifesting it behaviorally in what they're facing, because we'll all be dead when the environmental apocalypse happens, but I'm concerned that my children, who are college age, won't be. And yet they seem quiescent in the face of this, and I'd love to get Tom's thoughts on, you know, what can be done to light a fire under that generation, since you've done that before.
I haven't read The Angry Buddhist, but it's on my desk, Seth.
Oh, thank you very much.
Are you sounding like an angry Buddhist now?
No, I'm not angry today, or nor am I Buddhist.
I visited a Buddhist temple to talk to a wise man in Japan many years ago to ask him this question of, like, how would somebody with a religious mission, in this case Buddhism, face the environmental crisis. And after making me a cup of tea, the monk said two things that I'll never forget. One was, the world is ending. The earth is ending. The earth is dying.
Did he mean that week? Or was he thinking more?
Secondly, he said, therefore, compassion arises. So, no, he didn't mean that week. He meant, as a matter of fact, in geological time, all things pass, including even the earth. And in perceiving this, in understanding the suffering and the decline of things, we're left with compassion as a reason for action. That's what he said. He didn't have a concept of making progress, you know, in the Western sense, the
right.
Kind of thing that I would believe in. But he was motivated by this understanding that we're all dying and that we should therefore embrace compassion. So I think there are ways to approach the crisis that you're speaking of, and I agree with you. It, in a sense, it's worse than nuclear weapons, which is what we faced in the past and still do, but we thought the world would end in a nuclear blast. It may, but we've learned how to manage nuclear weapons, however precariously, and yet we don't have any way to manage global warming, the melting of the ice caps, the severe storms, the warming of the seas, all that. No way. And so it can be so overwhelming that I think it makes people retreat. And I think that you know, the way to go forward is out of compassion, and the environmental movement needs to wed compassion with some good strategic thinking about how to achieve what we can within the capacity that's available. I think that the movement associated with Bill McKibben that put a ring around the White House last year and was recently here, UCLA, caravanning to D.C. to demand, a radical reduction in warming, has tapped into an idealistic sentiment among young people that combines direct action, civil disobedience, lobbying pressure. And is it enough? Well, we'll see. I think that it's possible that in an ecological sense, we could make an adjustment, an adaptation, as a species adaptation at the last moment. Call it green jobs in the secular world, but it will take a leap of that kind.
I would love to see this coming from a youthful direction. I feel like, to look at it from our perspective, you alluded to something before when you said it's almost overwhelming. I mean, when you really think about what's going on and you look at it internationally and the fact that it's not just our country, of course, it's India, it's China. These are agrarian economies being yanked very, very quickly into the 21st century with massive unprecedented industrialization in terms of the speed at which it's happening. So there's that, and I feel when we look at it, we think, oh God, and you just want to take a Valium and lie down. But kids, college kids in their 20s, the same group that really ended the war in Vietnam. What upsets me is that they're not at the forefront of this, and I wonder what's going on with that. What are they not seeing? Did they not see what occurred in New York a month ago?
Well, it's my perception that to the extent anybody's in the forefront of this, it's young people, it's students, in the 350 movement around the country.
But doesn't it feel marginal compared to what was going on in Vietnam, which became very mainstream pretty quickly?
I would be careful to make those comparisons. I don't know how to compare decades, but I would say no, it's not marginal compared to. Here's my own view is that the environmental movement developed very, very rapidly, and in the course of social movements should have come to power with the election of Al Gore a decade ago, years ago.
That's true.
And then we would see how far an environmental president could reform our environmental ways. That was a loss. That was a staggering loss. That brought about a Bush-Cheney government with Cheney and the oil companies, the war in Iraq, and retrograde changes in the Supreme Court, and it was a disaster. So I think that's equivalent, although Gore's alive and well, that's equivalent to what happened to us with the murders of national leaders in the 60s.
That's a terrific point, actually. The tectonic plates of history were in place for that to occur. You're right. That's,
yeah.
I hadn't looked at it that way, and I think that's very accurate. So perhaps I'm coming down too hard on the college kids of today, I suppose.
Your next book, you might want to write a tragedy.
It's so easy, though.
On this note, let us stop for just 1 minute for a station break. Welcome back. This is Background Briefing with Ian Masters, although today it's with Tom Lutz, and I'm joined by Tom Hayden and Seth Greenland. We were just talking about youth movements. Your latest book, Tom, is about youth movements, the kind of history of the youth movements.
That's right. I've had an interesting journey because I've watched the pattern for 50 years, and one of the things that we stood for in the old days was participatory democracy, and I see that as ironically as like a gift that keeps on giving. In other words, just when you think everything is conformist and quiet, along comes, out of nowhere, comes a movement led by young people that surprises and that opens up a lot of possibilities. I think another example, probably the most important the past couple of years, has been the movement for the DREAM Act by young undocumented immigrants, many of them here in Los Angeles, but all around the country, who are having a national convention. I wonder what the FBI and the police think of that. It's a national convention of hundreds and thousands of people in Kansas City who are here illegally. And they've just succeeded in a de facto temporary amnesty and are cooking up their plans for next steps in terms of legislation, state and federal levels. And 2 years ago, they were hardly a speck in the eye. They are here today, and I think they probably achieved more under Obama through direct action and lobbying than any other movement in the country, with possible exception of the LGBT movement.
And I don't know how far we want to get into this, but it strikes me that perhaps we can think of Bradley Manning not as a movement, but as a young activist.
I think Bradley Manning is like a conscience of the generation. He reminds me, if you read his diaries, his blogs, it's a little like the Allen Ginsberg character in Howl. I would suggest to the LA Review that you look carefully at them with an eye to publishing them or putting them out as a pamphlet. The anguish of this young man, who was a closeted gay soldier at the time that the gays in the military issue was ripening to a new level, and who was a technician and looking at the logs of all of these atrocities, secretly inflicted atrocities, it had this profound alteration of his consciousness. It kind of broke his heart, and he became kind of crazy at what he was seeing on the screen, and that led him then to the disclosures for which he's on trial. But I don't think there's a movement for Bradley Manning, but there should be. But there's certainly a movement against excessive classification, and a movement to protect whistleblowers, like Assange and Manning. There may have to be new legal architecture concerning whistleblowing, but certainly they should not be punished with life imprisonment or that sort of thing, because they have revealed secrets that the American people, American taxpayers, American families are entitled to know about what we did in Iraq and these other places.
How do you deal with a Bradley Manning, though? Because I agree with you. I think there are certain things in a democracy that we need to know. And there are other things that perhaps it's impossible to operate a government without a certain amount of secrecy. Would you agree with that, or do you think a government should be entirely transparent?
That's a good question. No, I can't justify entire transparency. It's kind of a marginal to me, because the possibility of that in my lifetime and yours is just beyond my imagination. I'm trying to keep the shadows from falling further and the curtains from closing altogether. If I were looking at it from the White House point of view, I would say, well, you know, we have to keep some of these things secret. But, ladies and gentlemen, we have gone so overboard in secret classifications. There are so many tens of thousands of people with security clearances these documents are being classified in order to prevent the exposure of embarrassment and scandal, not anything that jeopardizes our real security. And I would issue a presidential order to rapidly increase the declassification of documents. With respect to Manning, you know, you're president, you can't let somebody go, but you could say that he's, you know, he's paid his price, he suffered enough. He was manhandled badly at Quantico, and a careful review of the documents shows that, you know, no American personnel have been injured or put in harm's way as a result of what was disclosed, and, you know, give him a pathway back to civilian life. Don't make him a scapegoat of a horrific and secretive war begun by under several presidents. Bush is out. Manning's in prison. Does that make sense to you?
And I worry that they will make a John Walker Lind example of him, which I personally don't think he deserves.
Yeah.
That's another one. John Walker Lind, at least I think, will be out. I think they brokered a deal.
Mm. Let's move to questions of justice. Thanks very much, Seth Greenland, for joining us. And now we have on the line Don Franzen, an attorney who specializes in entertainment and business law. Don is a fellow at the Los Angeles Institute for the Humanities and is the legal editor for the LA Review of Books. He has a special interest in the Supreme Court, as I suppose most of us do these days, and has recently written about the Affordable Health Care Act decision, and even more recently interviewed Justice Antonin Scalia for us. Welcome, Don.
Hello, welcome, Tom. Thank you.
Glad you could join us. Tom and I were talking yesterday about the Roberts Court and the possibility that the 5-4 majority might change during the next 4 or 5 years. Don, have you looked at the actuarial calendars, the charts?
There you go.
Yeah, the results, the election in November was potentially very momentous for the composition of the court, because as everybody, I think, who's read many newspapers in the last 4 years has noticed, is that it's essentially 4 solid conservative votes and 4 more or less solid liberal votes, and then Kennedy in the center being almost the kind of the Ohio, as it were, of the Supreme Court, you know, the vote you have to win in order to win. And coming up in the next 4 years, we have several justices who are getting up in years, or at least what most of us would consider up in years. Kennedy himself is 76. So is Scalia, although having just interviewed him, I have to say he's a very hearty 76. But Ruth Bader Ginsburg is about to turn 80 and has not been in particularly good health for some time, unfortunately. So we might, it would be reasonable to expect, and also Stephen Breyer is 74. So between all of those, there's the chance for one, possibly as much as 4 seats in the Supreme Court coming up during Obama's second term. So at a minimum, if actuarially speaking, we guess that Ginsburg, as the oldest, it would be the first to retire or leave the court for some reason. That would just be replacing a liberal vote, so that wouldn't change the court's composition. But should any of the others, Breyer also being a liberal vote, that wouldn't change the court's composition. But if for some reason Kennedy should have to step down, there might be a chance to actually change the 5-4 composition in the other direction. So actually what happened in November was very, very important for the future of the court.
And Tom, you were looking at a 5 or 6 year timeline.
Well, that's why I said, you know, the Hillary Clinton as a presidential candidate is extremely important, assuming that she's as viable in the future as she is now, because this business about the court is very often misunderstood at the grassroots level. But I'm glad
for Mr. Franzen's analysis there. My sense is that Obama will get one for sure, but he needs two, and that may take till the next president.
That's right. And if the second one is rare, then that doesn't change anything, really. It'll just keep, we'll still have the kind of 4-4 and one swing vote composition that we have now.
That's correct. I think it may take the next president to get to more, but I don't know. I do think that, I mean, I take as my viewpoint on this stuff Jeff Toobin's book, which I'm sure you've reviewed and read, and I think what Toobin says in his book should remind us of how important it can be to, in fact, politicize the court, if you will. I don't mean to put it quite so baldly, but it is politicized. It is a Republican majority, and we lost the Gore presidency because of these folks. And it doesn't need to be a left-wing court. It doesn't need to be a Democratic Party loyalist court, but it needs to be an independent judiciary. That's the point. And it could be that public pressure actually, as Toobin argues, made Justice Roberts obligated to protect the institutional interests of the court, not just his own extremely conservative agenda. What do you think?
That's exactly, I think, what happened. In fact, going back to the LA Review of Books, we ran an article on, like, the day after of the healthcare decision. Actually, I ran a review of a book that covered, like, the different theories of the Constitution, and commented on the fact that Roberts was maybe for the second time in history the switch in time that saved nine, because he was concerned about the institution of the court and wanted to preserve its neutrality and not have it be perceived as a you know, a political arm of one party or the other. So, yes, I think that's exactly what happened. He was probably acting more as a statesman than a partisan politician in doing that. So it's quite remarkable when you think about it that it was the health care law, the Affordable Health Care Act, was one vote away from being declared unconstitutional. I mean, it just squeaked by. We haven't had a situation like that since the 1930s, where a major act of national legislation seeking to address a large national problem and issue practically got overturned. You remember, you know, Tom, you know history as well as anybody. I mean, you're a student of history. You know how the Supreme Court got in trouble in the 1930s by routinely overturning New Deal legislation and practically almost destroyed itself as an institution. So that's probably what Roberts, I think he had that in mind.
I think it's in their DNA. But we'll see if it was just a temporary protective measure, because they could go after the Voting Rights Act, affirmative action. There's a whole number of other issues that are coming right down the road now that the election's
that's
over.
That's exactly right. If you look at the scorecard, I mean, coming up pretty soon is the Prop 8 case, the ban on gay marriage. They have some big affirmative action cases coming.
Yep.
They've got voting rights cases coming up about whether even to continue the Voting Rights Act in the South. They've got there'll be more litigation over campaign finance, federalist issues about the rights of states and their power to deal with illegal immigrants. So there's a lot of big issues in the pipeline for the court to deal with in the next year or two.
Thanks very much, Don. We're going to have to take a quick break. And when we come back, I'm going to be adding Ruben Martinez into the conversation. Thanks very much for being with us, Don.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking...
Welcome back to Background Briefing with Tom Lutz sitting in for Ian Masters. My guest today is Tom Hayden. We're running through a whole lot of topics very, very quickly, a little too quickly, I'm afraid. I wish we could have kept talking about the court and the War Powers Act and a number of other things, but that'll be for another show. Right now we have joining us Ruben Martinez, who holds the Fletcher Jones Chair at Loyola Marymount University. He's a writer on immigration and globalization and other topics, and a contributing editor at the LA Review of Books. His latest book is Desert America, Boom and Bust in the New Old West. That book reports on what he calls the outrageous wealth and devastating poverty, the sublime beauty and ecological ruin of the desert stretching from the Inland Empire to West Texas. Welcome, Ruben.
Great to be with you, Tom, and with Tom.
Both of you, Tom and Ruben, have been active in immigration rights, and there's quite a bit of overlap in your other concerns as well. But I know that both of you are interested in the fate of the DREAM Act, which has been kicking around Congress for over a decade now. Will it finally get passed this session?
Yeah. I'm not a great predictor of things, but I like most observers, I'm very optimistic about the DREAM Act and about comprehensive immigration reform overall. One of the great political and I think moral failures of Obama's first term was the fate of the DREAM Act and of comprehensive immigration reform in Congress. And it's ironic, of course, that that now that comprehensive immigration reform is really a real possibility, the wave of immigration that put this on the political front burner has pretty much evaporated because of the economic downturn. Upwards of a million immigrants have returned to Mexico and also to Central America since the bust in 2007, 2008. So we're about to, finally achieve this for the people that are here. But several people have already gone back home because of this tremendous economic distress we've had in just the last few years.
Yeah, everyone in this last election cycle seemed to subscribe to some idea of comprehensive immigration reform. They, of course, meant very different things by it. What would you both like to see? What would be comprehensive? Maybe Tom?
Well, hi, Ruben. How are you?
Great.
I'll comment on the DREAM Act. I mean, they're having their national conference as we speak out in Kansas City. And they'll decide what their agenda is. If they go forward with the DREAM Act as a standalone item along other parts of immigration reform, it's quite important because what they achieved essentially was a waiver from deportation, not even an executive order in the legal parsing of the White House. Obama clearly wanted to and planned on giving them some kind of assistance, but he balked at even an executive order. I remember being in meetings where it was suggested, and that seemed to be a stretch too far for the administration. But he came through, and 300,000 people have already been covered, and I think they'll get to a million by the end of this year. But they need it codified in law rather than being this vague waiver. And there I think the Republicans would be really hard-pressed to vote against it. I don't know what Mario Rubio would counsel, but I have a feeling that the DREAM Act in some form could survive the Congress and get to the president's desk. On the broader question, I'll leave that to my friend, but you're absolutely right. It's kind of a generic label for a subject matter, but we have to be quite specific what what the component parts of real immigration reform are.
Yes, the when we talk about comprehensive, of course, it means there's a lot of moving parts to any legislation that approaches this. The Republicans, of course, have always the business-friendly Republicans who want immigration reform have always done various iterations of kind of modern-day bracero program, you know, a guest worker type thing, which, of course, most unions, liberals, progressives would say, well, that's just codifying the exploitation that already exists in the system that's stacked against the migrants. Right? Liberals and progressives would not call that real comprehensive immigration reform. A pathway to citizenship, a substantial pathway to citizenship that, and to my mind, the best possible scenario is one where you don't punish the immigrants. It seemed that even most Democrats had signed on to basic legislation that would have the immigrants basically do a mea culpa. Yes, I am a criminal, and I will get to the back of the line, and I'm sorry. So it's kind of like, you know, hitting them with a stick and getting them to admit they've done this terrible wrong. And of course, that leaves out the fact that the employers have also broken the law, that we as a society have turned a blind eye to the fact that we're all, in one way or another, enjoying the fruits of this exploited disposable labor, and have done so for generations.
To change tracks just a little bit, we were talking earlier about rebuilding on the of the East Coast and how we're thinking about infrastructure needs need to take into consideration climate change. Having just finished this book about the southwestern desert. Ruben, how is this kind of applicable to the desert region?
Climate change overall, and the environmental issues—that's what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean that's a large part of, or it's a serious part of your book.
Certainly, yeah. The political economy of climate change in the Southwest is writ large, just like everything is writ large in the desert Southwest. You know, I like to refer to the desert of capitalism. You know, the extremes of capitalism in the Southwest. It's kind of endemic to the region. The boom and bust cycles have been more vicious, and they were certainly the most recent boom and bust cycle was most vicious in many of the Western states. The highest unemployment rates, the highest foreclosure rates, and alongside that, ecological ruin, which of course is tied to human modes of production, has wrought absolute havoc in the southwestern states. I don't think we necessarily think of environmental disaster in the West as much, you know, in terms of national media. It seems like the poster images of environmental disaster might be more, you know, fracking on the other side of the country. But the wildfires that have ravaged the Southwest in the last 5-10 years, we've had historic wildfires in every single state of the borderlands. The worst wildfires in Arizona, in Colorado, in West Texas. These are historic wildfires related to the drought, of course, and related to, of course, you know, our burning of fossil fuels. There also is fracking occurring in New Mexico and other parts of the Southwest. We've got a situation here, particularly with water, but also in other environmental concerns of absolute utter crisis. And it's the impact. We're just beginning to feel the impact in the borderland deserts.
And Tom, your environmental work has ranged from the very local, from the Santa Monica Bay to the global. Is the desert one of your interests as well?
Yes, I want to thank Ruben for this book, Desert America, which I have here on my lap. nice, quiet Sunday. And it's because the desert doesn't have witnesses or spokesmen the way populated areas do. It's had some anarchic and brilliant
voices, you know, like Ed Abbey and the Monkey Wrench Gang. But this is a place where the ecology and the indigenous both lack a relative voice. It's the site of the Mexican War, which has to be understood if you're going to understand the Southwest and immigration. It's the site of many of the last battles of the U.S. Army against the indigenous tribal people, whose societies and cultures still exist in the area. And it's also, as he points out, and only a writer like Ruben could point out, it's an area of remarkable beauty. I mean, it takes you into a journey in time where you are so far outside of the rhythms of Los Angeles or New York. It's just unbelievable to be in the Canyon de Chelly or some of these places. So, just because there aren't a lot of people there doesn't mean it isn't being devastated. I mean, I think a lot of people believe that because something is a desert, it's already dead. But no, deserts are alive. Deserts are ecosystems. Deserts are cultures that sustain all kinds of life. And this one is really morphing into some kind of disaster area that his book, I think, begins to describe and needs a voice. So thank God he's out here.
It's very much appreciated, Tom. The drought in the desert is not redundant. Piggyback on your final thought there, the desert is dry compared to other places, but it rains. It rains actually substantively in the desert. Anybody who spent a summer in the desert, in the southwestern desert, knows that the monsoon is critical to the biome. Now, during the time that I lived in New Mexico, which is basically where much of the book is set, we had historic drought years that led to these devastating fires. And there's nothing in recorded history that approaches what the swings in climate that as have been experienced in the Southwest. And this is true for other places as well. Of course, we know this is a global phenomenon, but the way it plays out in the desert is a very particular way, precisely because it is so fragile. And I think that's the thing about the desert. It teaches us lessons about life and politics, by the way. There's Arizona, right? Arizona is not just a place that's being ravaged by wildfires. It's being ravaged by a political wildfire of nativism. Jan Brewer and Russell Pierce and all those who brought us SB 1070 and the ban on ethnic studies in public schools there. That's the same state that hosted the sanctuary movement in the 1980s. So you've got, you know, extremes on both ends. The desert is a place of extreme nativism, but it's also a place of hospitality and solidarity. And so I think we can see all our problems up close and personal there. And we also have traditions that indigenous traditions and from south of the border that show us possibilities of a way out of the mess.
Thank you so much, Ruben, for joining us. Ruben Martinez,
great to be with you.
His new book is Desert America, Boom and Bust in the New Old West.
Thank you so much.
Tom, in our last few minutes here, I had a couple of things that I'd hope we'd get to that I'd like to ask you about. One is about your desire for reform, or is it a repeal of the War Powers Act? Is that on constitutional grounds, or is that a legislative process?
Well, the War Powers Act was written in 1973 by Congress. It was never supported by any subsequent president because it asserted some congressional control or participation in decisions to go to war. And it was meant a showdown with Richard Nixon. What I'm afraid of is that over the years, including this administration, we're reapproaching the era of the imperial presidency.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I think it needs to be relooked at. The War Powers Act doesn't necessarily cover drone warfare. It doesn't cover cyber warfare. It doesn't cover the CIA outsourcing to secret armies of thousands of people. It's really about the right of a president to dispatch ground troops into combat for a certain period of time, report to Congress, and pull them out if Congress doesn't approve in 60 days. That's it. That's the congressional check on the president's war-making powers. And I noticed with great interest President Obama's interview with John Stewart. You think he should have done the interview with Pacifica, but he did the interview with John Stewart.
He doesn't come here often enough.
He needed to be reined in, and future presidents needed to be reined in their powers, and he was calling on Congress and I guess civic society to construct legal architecture for these new forms of warfare, which he's freely employing and deploying for whatever reasons. But the result is secret war and secret executive branch on a grand scale. And I just don't believe, I know the listeners may disagree, which is fine, but I don't really believe that a constitutional scholar like Barack Obama, who ran for president opposing the Iraq War, would want to leave an imperial presidency as his main institutional legacy. I just think this is what happens when you're dealing with issues of terrorism and the threats of another 9/11, and you have a public that doesn't want any more Americans killed in combat. So it's fairly easy to push the drone button in a macabre way. And I think that we need to come up with a revision of the War Powers Act that covers all of these and that allows
for
greater transparency and for a check and balance function by Congress.
Thanks so much. That's the scary music coming up, Tom. We're unfortunately out of time. I really appreciate your joining me.
I'm delighted to have been here. Thank you very much, one and all.
Thanks. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Tom Lutz, sitting in for Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com. Ian will return tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye. Thanks. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by half.